Our reading today comes from the book of Exodus. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then God said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." God said further, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. On my first day of school, I got lost coming back from recess. I couldn't remember where my classroom was. Now, it wasn't a big school, and I'm sure I wasn't wandering around by myself for more than maybe a few minutes. But it was also new, and I really didn't know anyone there yet. It was kind of scary. Fortunately, before too long, somebody that I remember as being the milkman, however improbable that seems, helped me figure out where I was supposed to be. That's my first memory of getting lost. Certainly not the last time that it happened, but it's a pretty ordinary experience with a happy ending. But I've never forgotten it. There's something about being in unfamiliar territory. Not sure how to get to where you want to go or who can help you get there, that I think is almost universally unsettling. And most of us try to avoid it whenever possible. I've been thinking about this experience of getting lost because I'm reading a book called An Altar in the World, A Geography of Faith, by Barbara Brown Taylor, who is an Episcopal priest and college professor. She writes about the spiritual treasures that can be found in the bodily experiences of life on earth. Paying attention, walking on the earth, encountering others, saying no, feeling pain, and pronouncing blessings are just a few of the spiritual practices that she explores. But the chapter that I read recently and that is speaking to me right now is called The Practice of Getting Lost. The author describes how the cows in a pasture near her home in Georgia consistently follow the same well-worn 8-inch-wide paths through the hundreds of acres of grass at their disposal. They walk single file when they all want to get somewhere at the same time. They're so committed to those paths. She admits that she finds the paths convenient as well. They are either the shortest or the easiest routes between the most desirable points in the field, the good watering holes, the shade. They allow her to walk with confidence. She doesn't have to worry that she's suddenly going to come upon a sunbathing rattlesnake or a well-hidden groundhog hole. But when she does take a risk and walks through the tall grass without the help of those cow paths, she discovers that her senses are heightened, and she is able to detect in advance and avoid those dangers that she fears. More, it provides an opportunity to discover new and previously hidden delights, like a tiny wild blue iris in the grass. Taylor goes on to explain that although walking or driving a different route from usual is a pretty benign form of getting lost, you have to start somewhere. She writes, "If you do not start choosing to get lost in some fairly low-risk ways, then how will you ever manage when one of life's big winds knocks you clean off your course?" She adds that although the main advantage of this practice is in its application to being figuratively or spiritually lost, literal lostness is a good place to begin since the skills are the same. Managing your panic, marshaling your resources, taking a good look around to see where you are and what this unexpected development might have to offer you. When Dave and I took our honeymoon trip to New Zealand and Australia, we spent a week touring New Zealand's North Island, armed with plenty of maps, the most beat-up rental car I've ever seen, and not a whole lot of experience taking road trips as a couple. He knows I'm telling the story. Dave did most of the driving, which was just fine with me because it made me nervous to try to drive on the other side of the road, so I was the navigator. Now, the thing is, even when you have a map or lots of maps, you can't always tell from that picture exactly what the road is going to look like when you get there. So one day we were driving from this inland town called Rotorua, and we were heading southeast to the coast at a town called Wairoa. And the route that we were taking looked like the shortest route. It passed through Urewera National Park. Now, the portion of the road that went through the park was maybe a quarter of the total distance, and we were looking forward to some pretty scenery and probably having time to do some wine tastings before dinner when we got out the other side. But nobody told us, and we didn't think to ask, that driving through Urewera National Park is no small feat. It's best undertaken in a four-wheel drive, not a beat-up rental Corolla. The landscape went from these open, hilly, green pastures dotted all over with fluffy white sheep under wide blue skies to this dark, wild, rainforesty mountain region in about 5 minutes flat. Oh, and the road turned to gravel after the first half hour. Turns out it takes 3 hours to drive just that little section of the map that we thought we would be through in about 45 minutes. Three winding, steep, forbidding, wrong side of the road, saw three other cars the whole time, scenery from Lord of the Rings or possibly Jurassic Park, hours, feeling lost in the wilderness, even though I could track our progress on the map the whole time. Dave called it an adventure, which was probably the right attitude to have. Obviously, we came out of it fine, but I looked a little more closely at the maps and the symbols for what kind of roads we were going to be on for the rest of our trip afterwards. Getting lost can be risky, whether you choose it or not. It makes you vulnerable, which usually doesn't feel very good. But sometimes that presents amazing opportunities. Moses was a man who knew something about being lost. He spent his childhood and adolescence cut off from his birth family and culture. He was raised in Pharaoh's palace in Egypt with a secret identity as a Hebrew child. He was tormented internally by the treatment his people were receiving at the hands of the ruling family who had raised him. And so when he couldn't take the injustice or this disconnect anymore, he killed a man, an Egyptian man, who was beating a Hebrew person, one of his own kinfolk. When the crime became known, Moses fled to the desert to hide. He was cut off from both his families and all he had ever known. He settled in the land of Midian. He married a woman named Zipporah, and when she bore a son, they named him Gershom, for its meaning in Hebrew. For Moses said, "I have been an alien, a stranger, residing in a foreign land." With his new family, Moses kept sheep. And one day, when he was tending the flock, he led them beyond the wilderness to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now, that phrase, beyond the wilderness, may have some specific meaning in that geographic area. I didn't go into extensive historical research on that. But the phrase speaks volumes to me about how far we sometimes find ourselves from where we intended to be. Also, I'm pretty sure it means that Moses just wasn't paying attention and got himself good and lost, literally. But there on that mountain beyond the wilderness, miles from home or family, and eons from where he started out, Moses encountered a startling sight. A bush was blazing with fire, but it was not being burnt up. And instead of running for his life back to the safe and familiar, Moses takes it as an invitation to get even more lost. I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. And here's the great thing. God waits to see how Moses responds before addressing him directly. When God sees that Moses has turned aside from whatever little sheep path he had been on to get a closer look at this manifestation of the holy, then and only then does God speak directly to Moses, calling him by name, helping him understand what it means to walk on holy ground, and revealing that this is the same God who first called Moses' ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, to leave their home in Ur and set out on the first great spiritual journey toward becoming a covenant people in a promised land. Of course, the burning bush was also a beginning. The Hebrew people would have to wander 40 years in the wilderness of Sinai, becoming well and truly lost, with no route back to those old familiar cow paths in Egypt, before they could become the community that God longed for them to be. And although their wilderness years were full of hardship, struggle, doubt, conflict, and loss, they were also a holy and transformative time, a reference point forever after for the people who became known as Israel. Throughout the Torah, the first five books of the Hebrew Scriptures, one command is repeated like a refrain. The wording varies, but the gist of it is, "You shall love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." One of the gifts, then, of getting lost, of being a stranger in a strange land, is the capacity for empathy and compassion, the ability to understand the experience that others may be having in a place that is familiar to you, the desire to show care and attention to the needs of those who are struggling and lost in their lives. John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist movement, probably could have stayed safe in familiar settings and routines all his life if he had wanted to. He was born in 1703 as one of 19 children born, 10 of whom survived, to a minister and his wife. And in his 20s, he too was ordained a minister in the Church of England. When his father died, many friends of the family really pushed John Wesley to apply for the church where Samuel, his father, had served. But he resisted. Something led him off that beaten path to accept an invitation to travel to the province of Georgia in the American colonies to become the priest in the newly formed church in Savannah. While his primary role there was to minister to the English colonists, he was also eager to try his hand at missionary work, sharing the gospel with the Native Americans. The trip was a disaster from start to finish. On the way over, a storm came up, and the waves of the Atlantic so tossed the ship that the boat's mast broke, causing panic among most of the passengers. Now, John's faith at the time was based largely in reason and morality, and it offered very little comfort in the midst of that storm. But he did notice that as all of the English passengers on board ship were panicking and crying, there was a group of Moravians, a Protestant sect with Czech and German roots, who seemed completely unfazed by the storm, who calmly prayed and sang hymns the entire time. And he wondered what they had that he did not. Also on the boat that took him to Georgia, John met a young woman named Sophie Hopke, and they became romantically attached. When he later spoke to a colleague, another minister, about his feelings, his colleague advised him to break off the relationship. And stories of exactly what happened next are kind of unclear, and they vary a little bit, but there was some kind of miscommunication that resulted in John refusing to serve communion to Sophie and her new husband, which led to a lawsuit from them against John, a trial, a mistrial, further charges, and ultimately led to John Wesley leaving town quietly in the middle of the night to take a boat back to England. He jumped bail. Oh, and he was a failure as a minister during that time as well. His sermons were too harsh, too rigid for the colonists, and he had no success in converting American Indians to Christianity. He was lost. He returned to England depressed and beaten, and utterly lost in his sense of calling and purpose. Yet it was only a few short weeks later that John Wesley had the pivotal experience of his spiritual life. After witnessing the deep personal faith of that group of Moravians on the ship, he began to attend their meetings in London. And it was at one of these meetings in Aldersgate Street, a Bible study and prayer meeting, that he felt his heart strangely warmed by an assurance of God's love for him personally, which became the basis of his theology and ministry from that day forward and launched the entire Methodist movement. Had he not been willing to take the chance of getting lost in America, with the failure and self-doubt that followed, he might never have become vulnerable enough to seek out such a transformative encounter with the living God, one that would spark his passion for sharing a gospel of grace and freedom with all who were worried that they were not pleasing enough to God. And we might not be here today. I find hope in these stories and encouragement. As some of you may know, lately there have been a number of changes in both my personal and professional life, not only here but in my other job. And sometimes they've left me feeling a little lost. Changing roles and relationships, friends moving away, trying to manage new responsibilities without losing a sense of myself and what's important to me. There's no really good map for this journey. So many of the changes are out of my direct control, and at times it feels like this is not where I set out to get to. Perhaps some of you may find yourselves in some kind of similar situation or feeling even more lost in one way or another. But the good news of Moses' story and John Wesley's and many others like them is that even when we find ourselves lost in the wilderness, far from home and unsure how to find our way back, God is with us. In fact, sometimes it is in the wilderness that God is revealed more fully to us than ever happened in the safe and familiar. So, at Barbara Brown Taylor's suggestion, I am working on managing my panic, marshaling my resources, taking a good look around to see where I am and what these unexpected developments might have to offer. And I believe I am still standing on holy ground. I pray that whenever any of us feel lost, our vulnerability will open us up to the gifts and insights, the details and blessings that we never would have seen on the safe but ultimately restricted cow paths that we used to travel. May we all find ways to embrace the adventure and the spiritual practice of getting lost. Amen.